I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The first time I ever figured out there was something strange about people and birds, I was reading a story of one noted ornithologist of the last century. James Henry Fleming used the same method as many birders did then. He went hiking, not with a pair of binoculars, but with a light gauge shotgun. Over the course of his life as a naturalist, he had amassed a collection of some 30,000 bird skins. I remember one story in particular. Remember the passenger pigeon? Now, just at the time when it was thought to be going extinct, Fleming was gazing out his window when he actually saw one. True to form, he ran for his gun and got a couple of shots off, but he missed. He claimed to be utterly heartbroken. Well, the good news is that birders today are a lot more interested in seeing birds than shooting them. They compile lists. Seasonal lists, state lists, life lists of every species of bird they have actually seen. Now, that's a practice which I thought seemed quite normal. That is until I read a new book on birding called The Big Year. In this case, birding becomes a competition. People race to see as many birds as they possibly can in one year. The writer, Marco Masek, puts it quite succinctly. There are, he writes, 675 birds that commonly live in North America, and there are 365 days to see all of them. Find two new birds a day, and you're the new champ. Doing the math is easy. Living it is madness. And so what is it with birds? Why do ordinary people go to such extraordinary lengths to see a little colored puff of feathers anyway? Are you in this class of extreme birder? Have you done your big year? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is the writer, Mark Obmasek, author of the book, The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl Obsession. Mark, good of you to join us.
Thanks for having me.
How did this all start? Was it your own interest in birds, or was it you as a reporter taking an interest in these people doing this unusual thing?
Well, I got started because I was naturally interested in obsession as a really interesting thing to write about. Mm-hmm. I was a newspaper reporter for 19 years and had done my share of gruesome stories, was a lead writer for our Pulitzer on the Columbine High School massacre, did some September 11th of coverage and some others, and frankly, I got to the point where I wanted to be able to write something that my kids could read. If you think of the front page of the paper, it's generally man at his worst. And then I found these three guys who got in this epic competition, this epic contest over, of all things, birds. And I just thought that it was just too much fun to pass up.
Now, the year in which this happened was 1998, right?
That's right. It was the strongest El Nino on record. So there were all these bizarre winds that were blowing freak birds in from Europe, from Asia, up from Latin America. And these days, with the information revolution, there are a lot of places in America where within just an hour or two of any rare bird landing, it'll be on the internet. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people from all over the country, all over the continent, who will chase these species.
Now, help me out for a minute here. If there's a bird which is native to, I don't know, Chile or something, and only that coast of South America, and it gets blown up into a garden in somebody's neighborhood in California, does that count on the list of birds seen in North America? You know, you understand what I mean?
You bet. And it's actually a tricky answer. Usually if it can be shown that it got naturally blown off course, you know, maybe a hurricane blew it up from Cabo San Lucas or someplace like that, then you bet people will chase that like mad. However, there have been some pretty good fights over the years on some gulls, for example, that are believed to have actually hitched a ride on some oil tankers or freighters from Africa. Now, they show up in America. You can't count those because they came along with somebody's help. You've got to have a bird that gets here of its own accord.
And so some green parakeet that escapes from somebody's cage that's spotted in a backyard doesn't count, right?
Oh, that's right. It drove birders nuts for years, in fact. The Hialeah racetrack outside of Miami was home to just dozens of flamingos, and it was just a spectacular thing. They'd start a horse race, and the flamingos would be up in the air, and it was just wonderful. But they're not wild birds. So birders would have to brave just one of the most brutal mosquito-infested trails anywhere in the Everglades, get there at dawn and try to survive this trek, you know, 2 miles out through the muck of the Everglades just with hopes of glimpsing some faraway, wild flamingo that had, you know, was like a dad on a road trip that refused to stop and ask for directions. Somehow it got lost en route from the Bahamas and ended up in the Everglades, and that's when it shows up in these rare bird alerts, and people from all over the continent converge upon it.
Now, though the year of the competition, 1998, had passed by the time you got your hooks into the story, you spent time with these three birders. Did you go birding with them as well, Mark?
I did, and it was amazing to me. That's part of what really hooked me on this story. These guys are like grown-up Tom Sawyers. They've just got this incredible, indestructible sense of optimism. They're running around like little boys on a treasure hunt, and it's just it's amazing. In fact, the first time I went birding with one of the guys I wrote about named Greg Miller, he was just so full of life, but I thought he was playing a David Letterman trick on me. We stopped at some woods near his house and hopped out of the car, and then all of a sudden Greg starts calling out, "Sedge wren, marsh wren, lazuli bunting, northern cardinal." He hadn't even lifted up his binoculars. I thought he was pulling my leg. It turns out, though, that Greg, the way that he had learned to bird was not first by sight, but by ear. I mean, some people can identify all the Rolling Stones songs by the first three chords of each song. Greg knows virtually every song of every native bird to North America. It's just an unbelievable thing to see.
As a matter of fact, Greg is joining us now on the line from the studios of WKSU in Kent, Ohio, and listening in. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Are you really that good? Can you just take it and tell me what the bird is?
For a majority of the birds of North America, yes. There's a number of birds of the 675 that do occur in North America. There's probably 100 to 125 that don't often make any sound or call. And then there's maybe another 100 or so, 150, that... The songs are very similar or part of a species or family that I don't know as well. There's about 450 that I know reasonably well for North America.
Now, did you spend a lot of time with headphones on and putting CDs in, or did you actually learn this in the field?
Both. I have to say, had I not been with my father, who was good with bird songs from knee-high to a duck, this would have been a daunting task, because just picking up a cassette tape or a CD with bird songs on it and memorizing them is a rather difficult task. But once you are in the field and you know and can recognize some bird songs, then listening to a CD or a cassette becomes an easier task. It's still something that requires a lot of work, and it's something that I do every year.
Your dad actually had a pretty good ear for this and taught you a lot.
Outstanding ear. He didn't have the resources that you and I have today. He would listen to a sound and not recognize it, and he would go hunt it down and find out what was making that sound or call. And he learned all his bird songs that way.
Now, speaking of resources, I read the story of your big year, and I was left wondering at times whether or not you had the resources as well. You started out with something like $7,000, borrowed what, another $8,000 from the bank of Dad?
Yes, I did.
Maxed out all your credit cards. What did you spend, Greg, in your big year?
I spent just over $31,000.
And let me come back to Mark Obmasek, because the cost of doing this, of flashing around the country for birders, is phenomenal. The $31,000 actually turns out to be a bit of a bargain, Mark.
Greg did it
actually,
on the cheap.
it was a bit of a bargain.
Greg was up against two guys who had quite a bit more money. In fact, one of the guys was spending between $8,000 and $12,000 a month. I mean, these are people who would do a lot of the old, it's like the old Hertz car commercial ads. They were running through the airport to catch these last-minute full-fare flights just to chase a rumor of a rare species. I mean, there's one guy, who a New Jersey industrial contractor, one of Greg's competitors, he basically day-tripped it twice to Point Barrow, Alaska, just to try to see one particular gull, a Ross's gull. It's a bird that's a little bit pinker, a little bit smaller than most. The first time that Sandy Comito went there, and spent all, I mean, the logistics of getting to Point Barrow, Alaska from New Jersey are pretty formidable. You've got to go from Newark to Seattle, Seattle to Anchorage, Anchorage to Nome, and then in Nome you grab a, I don't know, it's not a puddle jumper. I think it's a tundra jumper. And he grabbed that to point barrel. Well, Sandy got there in time to see the native Yupiks butchering the bowhead whale that was going to get him through the winter, but no bird. And Sandy got really concerned that there was a storm moving into Alaska. He was really afraid that he might be stranded in Alaska for a few days when there might be another good bird that would show up in the lower 48. So he got out of Dodge. He went back home and chased some more birds down in the continental U.S. But, I mean, he's a real perfectionist, and I think it really bugged him that he didn't see that bird up in the northern reaches of the planet. And so he retraced his contrails, went back just a few weeks later and did see the bird that time.
Oh, man.
An enormously expensive undertaking.
Now, Greg Miller, you at one point take off for Tulsa, Oklahoma, looking for a bird. This is one of your sort of lost moments of the big year.
Indeed. I could not afford toward the end of the year buying a very last minute plane flight to go chase a bird. So I had to rely on the 7-day pre-purchase deals. And I had purchased a 7-day advance. I still hadn't seen Lesser Prairie Chicken because I'd missed it in the spring. And so I was going to go after Lesser Prairie Chicken in southwestern Kansas, and I could fly to Tulsa. So I purchased tickets to Tulsa. Well, in between the time that I'd purchased non-refundable tickets, I found out about a northern jacana in southeastern Arizona. And
that's a bird, right? A northern jacana? Sorry, I'm having trouble keeping up.
Yeah, that's the bird I went after.
Arizona?
Yes.
Okay, so what, you flew to Tulsa and then drove or what?
Yes, it did. After I landed in Tulsa, I figured out I had 65 hours from the time that I landed till the time that my plane took off again. So I had 65 hours to drive 1,200 miles one way to southeastern Arizona to try for this bird. And I got there early Saturday morning, and the last the bird had been seen was Friday night, the night before. So I missed it by a matter of hours, and I had to jump back in the car and drive the 1,200 miles back to Tulsa to catch my flight.
Did you get the Lesser Prairie Chicken in Kansas?
No, I sure didn't.
You got nothing on this one venture then.
I got nothing there, but I had a layover in St. Louis, and I picked up a native bird there called a Eurasian tree sparrow.
All right.
So I did add one for the year, but had I not planned on doing that, it would have been a fluff trip.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, you are listening to Stories of Extreme Birding. Mark Obmasek is with us. He's got a new book out called The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl Obsession. One of those obsessed people, Greg Miller, is with us on the program as well. We'd like to hear your stories of birding. Were you out this weekend? Have you gone over to the extreme side of actually trying to do a big year, if not in the lower 48 in your state? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. A special welcome today to folks in the area of East Lansing, Michigan, who are joining us through the good graces of WKAR, which begins broadcasting The Connection today. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join our daily conversation here. And today, my guests are Mark Obmasek. He's the author of a book called The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl Obsession. Greg Miller, who is one of those obsessed birders, is also joining us from Kent, Ohio. And you know what I should do, Mark, is get you to give me that description in the book, the one that you wrote of the that place in Texas where Al Levinson, one of your obsessed birders, go. And I say that place in Texas because I don't want to sort of give away your description. Can you read us a little passage? You know the one I'm referring to?
You bet. I'll try here. Here we go. Some birders called it the Tamaulipas Crow Wildlife Sanctuary. Others preferred the Brownville Nature Preserve. Those with a Latin flair opted for the Corvid National Park. But Al Levinton, who was never one for pretense, simply called it the dump. For the past 30 years, the Brownsville, Texas Municipal Landfill had been the only reliable place in the United States to see a Tamaulipas crow. Nobody besides the crow liked going there. To say it stunk did injustice to the word stunk. It reeked. It rotted. It marinated decades of throwaway table scraps in the fecund humidity of the Rio Grande Valley and then roasted it under the South Texas sun. It smelled so bad, it made grown men cry. Brownsville was one of the few major landfills anywhere that still admitted birders. Most insurers and city attorneys refused to let passenger cars share a dump road with trash haulers en route to their honey hole. But Brownsville was a border town, anxious to promote non-border businesses. If bird watchers wanted to spend their tourism dollars pointing $1,000 binoculars at heaping mounds of trash, the city elders here weren't about to block their view.
That's Mark Obmasek reading from his new book, The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Foul Obsession. In fact, Mark, going through the book, there's lots of places where people go looking for birds which aren't exactly the virgin pine forests of northern Minnesota.
It's a pretty broad definition of wild America. In fact, these three guys in The Big Year, I think, became some of the world's foremost experts on the dumps and sewage lagoons of North America. They had to go where the birds were, and frankly, birds sometimes go to really stinky places. There's others that were wild as well. There's a few species of birds that generally just live in the suburbs of Miami. They have great names, you know, spot-breasted oriole, red-whiskered bulbul. But the problem is they like to hang in people's backyards. And so these three men would go independently with their binoculars in these suburban neighborhoods of Miami around Kendall. And inevitably, the neighbors would start calling them out as perverts. What's this guy doing in the backyard with binoculars? So one of the big challenges got to be for these guys, if possible, try to find a woman birder who they could go out with, because it's one thing for a man to go out with binoculars in somebody's backyard, but if a man is paired up with a woman, then I think they're less likely to call out the dogs on you.
Did you ever get in trouble, Greg, for stepping around someone's backyard feeder?
No, I would always either ask for permission or the people would know that I was coming for backyard feeder birds. But walking down streets, I got plenty of stares because you'd walk past people's yards and stuff.
Just eyeballing the backyard in each case, right?
Of course. I guess there's trees in people's backyards and the birds will fly in and out of yards. So the direction you pointed your binoculars might elicit a not-so-pleasant stare.
Well, and in fact, one thing that happened to all three of these guys during their big year is they had different run-ins with the Border Patrol. I mean, Greg, I think that happened to you. What happened there?
I was in just west of Phoenix, not actually very close to the border, but I was out in the middle of nowhere looking for thrashers in a field, and it was raining, so I was out in a rainstorm in Arizona in the middle of nowhere. I'd climbed back into my car, which is pulled off to the side of the road, and the next thing I know, I got these flashing lights behind me, and an officer walks up to the window, taps on the window, says, "What you doing here?" I said, "Bird watching." To which he said, "Well, nobody does any bird watching here." Well, and maybe he was brand new, or maybe he was just giving me a hard time. But I had a cassette tape in my hand, and I was listening to bird calls. So I played some bird calls for him, and I had a bird guide with me, and I showed him some of the birds I was looking for, so it turned out okay, but run-ins with Border Patrol is a fairly common thing when you're birding in North America.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join us. We're going to take a call from Saranac Lake, New York. Tom's on the line. Tom, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I'm just about halfway through Mark's book right now, and as a matter of fact, I've just gotten through the section where your guest had a run-in with the Border Patrol. I've probably been in the same area looking for Lacan's thrasher. During 98, I was doing what I would call a small big year on my own, taking a vacation and traveling around the country, not nearly as extensive as the three main characters in the book, But it was interesting because reading the book, the characters in the book and I both, or all, were chasing the same birds. I was up in Gibson, British Columbia, and did get to see the Xanthus hummingbird. I was down in Patagonia Lake State Park in southeastern Arizona chasing the Nunnings flycatcher. I think it was 3 days after Sandy was there. I missed it, and so did everybody else that day.
So, Tom, is this like your job, chasing birds? Or
Gosh, no. No, I work in human services.
So how do you find the time to get all the way, you know, to either end of the continent chasing birds?
Well, I used the Internet to see what was available, and I was, during this one main trip, I was had 3 weeks vacation. I was going up to British Columbia for a family reunion and then decided afterwards that, well, I might as well try for the hummingbird. Got that. And on my way home, I decided to take a roundabout route through Phoenix, Arizona to see my daughter. And
can I just stop you with this hummingbird? Because this is one of these backyard stories that's left me shaking my head. At some point, Mark, if I've got this right, this is the hummingbird that's showing up at one person's feeder on a fairly regular basis. And the poor people who have the feeder just have this parade of birders coming in and out of their house.
Right. This is really where the birding phenomenon hits home. What happened was apparently there was some sort of a hurricane that hit Cabo San Lucas and blew up this Xanthus's hummingbird up to Gibson's, B.C. near Vancouver. It's a little bird that's about the size of your pinky, just a brilliant iridescent green. And when the word went out, people went nuts. And so what happened is the main way to get into Gibson's is to ride the ferry from Vancouver over to Gibson's, B.C. Well, the Pacific Northwest being what it is in the weather, the first thing everybody would do before getting on the ferry is coffee up. They would load up on coffee, which meant that when they got to these poor people's driveway where the bird was coming into the feeder, everybody really, really had to go. So finally, the people, the Pattersons, Jerry Patterson, were really sweet, and they really took pity on these miserable people outside in the Pacific Northwest winter in the rain waiting for this tiny little bird to show up at a feeder. They finally took pity on him, and frankly, I think they got tired of people ringing their doorbell to ask to use the bathroom. But they actually went and rented a portalette, and they put it in their driveway where people could, you know, you can't buy coffee, you can only rent it. But I think that they had a guest book, and there literally were, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 people.
Is that right,
Tom? Signed the guest
book. Yes, they did have a guest book, and that's not unusual. And I found that even though these folks, which often happens, we're not what you would call hardcore birders. They were more than accommodating and very kind and generous in allowing birders from all over to use their property and you know, come there and see a bird that for most of us would be just unreachable. And it's happened to me before.
I got a quick question for you, Tom, before I let you go, and that is just simply, why do you do this? Why is it so important?
Well, you know, when I was a younger man, my dad was a hunter and a fisherman, and I started out that way. And as I grew older, I still loved the hunt, but I didn't care to shoot anything anymore. And to me, birding is a lot like hunting. It's a chase. It's an accomplishment. And there's also the connection with these birds that travel from all over. On migration, I mean, a barn swallow that you see up in New York is going to spend the winters down in, you know, the Amazon jungle. And to me, that's always been fascinating.
How many on your life list, Tom?
640 and counting.
Greg Miller, how many?
A trip this summer.
Greg Miller, how many are on your life list?
756. I was going to ask Tom what his mini big year, how well did you do?
Oh, he's left us.
He's left us? Oh,
yeah,
it's too bad.
But 756 on your life list. What are you missing?
Oh, still missing a lot of accidentals and vagrants. But of the regularly occurring birds in North America, I'm missing Gunnison sage grouse, which was a split, I believe, in 99. an Arctic warbler in Alaska. It's a late migrant, and I was there early. Red like a kittiwake. You need to go to the Pribilofs for that. And whiskered auklet. You need to go to the middle Aleutian Islands for that. So that's what I'm missing.
It used to be a phenomenal accomplishment for people to see 600 birds in their lifetime. Now, I mean, these guys, in the big year, these guys each saw more than 700 birds in 1 year. It's amazing. Part of what really launched this phenomenon was kind of the patron saint of modern birders, Roger Torrey Peterson, once in the 1950s took this great buddy trip. He and the great naturalist of the UK, James Fisher, hopped in a car, put a parabolic reflector on the roof so that would magnify bird calls and they could listen, and set off from Labrador and just drove down the East Coast across the Gulf Coast and up the Pacific, and really wrote this wonderful little time capsule of a story called Wild America, a book, and it's a terrific look at the U.S. in the days before the interstate highway system. And they talk about driving through Southern California, and you know there was no sprawl. There was just mile upon mile of orange groves, and seeing, you know, warblers, just streams and parades of warblers filling the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. Well, in this wonderful travel log, Peterson noted with a little asterisk at the bottom of one page, by the way, we saw 572 birds in 1 year. Well, that was kind of the little asterisk set in agate type that launched the whole big year phenomenon, because after that, people just said, hey, you know, I can match that, or I can beat it.
That was the 4 minute mile for extreme birding. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Bellingham, Massachusetts. Now, Barbara's on the line. Barbara, thanks for calling.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
So, are you a birder?
No, I'm not. That's what I was just going to say, is I'm not really, other than sitting out here by the pond out where I work watching goldfinches in the summertime. But I do understand the excitement that birders might feel about seeing rare birds. When I was a teenager, about two more years ago than I'd care to admit, I was on a whale watch out of the aquarium in Boston. We were on our way back. It was late in the afternoon, and they actually stopped the boat out in the middle of the water because there was this little bird just beating its wings to death trying to reach the boat. So they stopped and let it land. And it turns out it was some bird from South Africa that had been blown this far north and this far west by a hurricane.
Do you remember what it was called, Barbara?
I don't remember. I wish I did. But I do know that I called the aquarium for months, just asked, how's the bird? How's the bird? Until they could get it back to health and get it back to wherever it really belonged. And so, like I said, I can understand the excitement.
There
because
is.
Because it was, even 25 years later, I remember.
There is in Mark's book a description that he writes of a hummingbird making its way across the Gulf of Mexico. Is that right, Mark?
Yes. I mean, one of the things I think that gets people going on birds is just the phenomenal things that they do. Most people take it for granted. The birds are mundane. They're so universal. You see them everywhere. And that's the reason why the famous Hitchcock movie was so effective. It turned the everyday against us. Well, there is one bird that is a pretty common bird on the East Coast in the summer called a ruby-throated hummingbird, about the size of your pinky, so light that you can actually mail 10 of them for the cost of a single first-class postage stamp. I mean, it's a teeny bird. Well, what this bird does every April is, first of all, it gorges itself for about 3 weeks beforehand. No Atkins diet for these guys.
Now, where is they're it just, at this point, Mark?
These are in the Yucatan of Mexico, the tip of Mexico. And they just, they're going for bugs. They're going for nectar, you know, whatever they can eat for about 3 weeks beforehand. And what they're doing is building up fat stores. They get these little yellow globules in their breast. Well, for some reason, and we still don't fully understand this phenomenon, but on one magical night, these birds, millions of them, tens of millions of them sometimes, will just take off at night from the Yucatan. Their job is to cross 500 miles of the Gulf of Mexico without stopping. If they stop, they die. They can't land on the water. And so they go, and it's just, it's this amazing journey where they're giving it their all. They're depleting all their fat stores. And they get to shore in Texas after 500 miles, these teeny creatures, and they're spent. They usually have no fat reserves left. In fact, sometimes, especially when they confront a headwind or a storm, they've started to actually cannibalize their body to hit those trees, their first landfall. They've consumed their muscle tissue. And then when they finally see landfall, they just drop like a hailstone from the sky, and these birds form. They turn these privet bushes, these live oaks, into these just magnificent, almost like Christmas trees, full of warblers, full of scarlet tanagers, summer tanagers, and ruby-throated hummingbirds. And yet, you know what? Ruby-throated hummingbirds are one of the more common birds that you'll see on the East Coast in the summer. But this is part of their everyday life. Everybody makes this amazing journey across the Gulf. It's just something we take for granted.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And when we come back after the short break, a chance to talk a little bit further with Mark Obmasek and Greg Miller about The Big Year, a tale of man, nature, and fowl obsession, this sometimes insane pursuit of birds in any corner of the continent as people try to tally up their number and win for the big year. 1-800-423-TALKS, the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and at this very moment all over this country, people are looking out their car windows and their house windows at birds and tallying them up for the list of the day or a life list. We actually have a call now from Cary, North Carolina. Brian's called in. Brian, where are you?
I'm in Cary, North Carolina on Aviation Parkway, which is a road that crosses through Lake Crabtree. It's kind of a county park, and the road goes right through the middle of a lake. And if you're driving towards the airport on this road and you look to the left, there's a tall pine sort of singled out right on the lake. And the top of that pine is an American bald eagle's nest. And in that nest, there's usually at least one, if not two, bald eagles.
Can you see the nest from where you are now, Brian?
I just drove by it. But, yes, you can see it right from the road. It's a huge nest right in the top of the pine. And the male does have the white head, so he's definitely of age. And it's an amazing sight, and we keep binoculars in the car, so when we're driving by, if they're nesting, we kind of pull to the side of the road and watch them. They're amazing birds.
I was a little worried there that you were going to be talking to me on the cell phone and watching the bird out the window and trying to drive at the same time. Thanks for calling in, Brian.
Sure, have a
you
great
know, one,
day.
One of the more terrifying things you can do is be a passenger in a car with a birder at the wheel, because they're not watching the road. They're always looking up at the sky, it's the one thing where when somebody cries duck, they look up.
Now, Mark, the three that you tracked around the country. Greg is a guest on the program, but of the other two, I'm trying to think of a delicate way of asking this question. I love doing radio programs with people who are obsessed about things because I begin by thinking these guys are nuts. And then when I get into it, I figure out that, you know, it's a fabulous thing that they're into, and they're so taken by it, I get drawn in as well. And I'm wondering whether or not you had the same experience in following these crazy birders or their stories.
Oh, yeah. These guys sucked me in. I went native on this one. After a career in newspapers usually it is man at his worst, to be out with guys who just did exactly what they wanted to do for a year, I mean, most people live their lives with the brakes on. And, I mean, these guys took it off, and they went for it. And just this tremendous sense of enthusiasm. They're just so much fun to be around. And initially, that was my interest. I love being around such you know, bubbly, really fun people, smart, funny people. But then the more I went out with them, the more I kind of started to share the love of the object of their affection. So now I'm definitely not a competitive birder, a competitive lister, but it's still it's a wonderful thing to do. I mean, the caller before talked about the bald eagle that he may see on his commute on the way to work. This past winter, my father-in-law came in. I live in Colorado. He's 72. I'm 42. We have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. One day we strapped on snowshoes and found this stretch near the Colorado River with about waist-deep snow. And so the four of us trekked through this snow to an unfrozen stretch of the river where there are box elders behind and a run of kokanee salmon in the river. And the box elders above the stream were a dozen bald eagles. Now, if you're a competitive birder, I mean, a bald eagle, that's not really any great shakes. You can find them pretty easily. But just the thought to me of being able to do something with a 72-year-old, a 42-year-old, a 9-year-old, a 6-year-old, and, you know, all different abilities, but everybody really came away having a terrific time. It's a wonderful thing that, I mean, birding's a terrific, really fun thing that you can do that makes you use both your legs, your heart, and your brain.
So Greg, it brings me to a question that I was wondering about as I was reading Mark's story, and that is, in your sort of mad dash off to some corner of the country to make a check mark beside the name of a bird, do you allow yourself the time to look at the bird to go, it's kind of cool to see that bird? Or is it more like a scavenger hunt where you just grab it and run?
Well, it was a little bit of both that year. I've been birding ever since I was very small, and lots of the birds that I had seen, I was already very familiar with. So on those, I did not spend a lot of time with. But there are other birds that were brand new for my life, and those I tried to spend a little more time savoring the moment, knowing that I might not get to see this one again in the very near future. And there are a lot of other experiences. The focus was birds, but I have to say, I enjoyed a lot of the other experiences I had as well. Seeing marine mammals in particular, I was fascinated with seeing my very first blue whales, seeing gray whales, orcas, sea turtles. It was a grand experience.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Burlington, North Carolina, and Sue's joining us on the line. Sue, it's good of you to call.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to tell you that my husband and I aren't big listers or anything, but we do enjoy competitive birding, and we've kind of gotten hooked into it. And I had to chuckle about when you were talking about down in Miami, because when we were first married, we got in touch with a person down there that gave us places to go in Miami to bird. So here we were in the early morning in the rain in a trailer park, and there was a bird in the tree. The people put a banana in the tree to bring this one bird in. And then we did go to the Miami sewage disposal dump, and, you know, everyone kind of chuckled. What in the world were you doing there? And we said, well, all these neat birds were there. But anyway, through the years, I agree with what he just said. You can go to a place and no one else thinks, like down to the Everglades, you can spend a week down there just looking for bird and bird life and the insects and everything, and you just get so much more out of each area where you are, and you don't have to spend a lot of money doing it. And that's, I think, one of the really great things. Like you said, you can backpack your kids and go out with your binoculars and spend just a wonderful day. My husband and I have kind of gotten into going to exotic places and seeing the birds. And
Let me stop you if I can, Sue, because there's an exotic place I want Greg to tell us about. He went to this island as far to the north and the west as you could possibly go in search for birds called Attu. Did I pronounce that right, Greg?
The Attu was correct.
That sounds like an unbelievable place.
It was quite an incredible place. It's got mountains that are about 4,000 feet tall, and we birded along the southeastern shore of this small westernmost Aleutian Island, which is about 1,200 miles west of Anchorage and about 300 miles east of the Kamchatka Peninsula of eastern Russia.
You're closer to Russia than you are than to the United States when you're doing this.
Quite a bit closer. If you ever look at a globe and you look at the international dateline and it goes down and it makes this little chink in the northern hemisphere and then it goes straight down after that, that is so that Attu can be included in the same time zone as the rest of Alaska, as opposed to being on a different day.
And Mark tells a story of you moving somewhat uncomfortably around the island on a mountain bicycle. Is that right?
That would be correct. I bought a bicycle before I went, knowing that our only form of transportation would be hiking and biking. And I only rode my bike 10 miles before I went to the island. But when I got there, we biked over territory that was not blacktop. It was marshy tundra and spongy, and there were puddles and foot-deep water and mud, and it was extraordinarily difficult. And my leg muscles felt like they were on fire after the first day, and my my bottom just felt awfully sore from sitting on a bike seat and not being accustomed to it.
Though there were some remarkable birds spotted at that time, Mark. And nobody gets to go to Attu anymore, is that right?
No, Attu is pretty much shut down. What happened was that the FAA concluded that the runway out there was getting a little unsafe. The only way to get to Attu was through these chartered flights. And so every year what would happen for several years is that 60 of the world's greatest birders, all united with this single consuming passion, this consuming obsession, would band together and go on a chartered flight to Attu and wait for these big vacuum cleaners of storms to suck up birds from Siberia and dump these Asiatic birds in North American airspace just so they could count them. Attu is just a miserable, godforsaken place, I think. 270 days of the year, it either rains or snows. And the other days are all foggy. And so it's cold. The waves are coming in, 30, 40-foot waves. The winds are up to 60 knots. They always seem to be in your face when you're mountain biking on Attu. And people pay $5,000 to vacation there. That's what these birders do. And it's phenomenal. They find these unbelievable birds. And, a lot of birders have stories about how over the years they've been teased about their obsession, Miss Jane Hathaway of the Beverly Hillbillies. But on Attu, everybody's got the same devotion, the same consuming interest.
You're there with a club of like-minded people. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now Owen's on the line. Owen, thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. Great show.
So are you a birder?
I am. And, in fact, I am not just a birder, but I'm a bird lover. I love the whole subject of birds, and I'm actually obsessed with woodpeckers. And I was in Newfoundland last summer, and there had been a forest fire there the previous year. And there are certain species of woodpecker, such as the black-backed and three-toed, which are generally very widely dispersed in the northern hemisphere in the Arctic forests, in the boreal forests. And when there's a forest fire, it makes it a lot easier to find beetle grubs, and so they converge upon these areas, and I happened to be up in Newfoundland at the time. And
So your idea of fun is walking around in the ashes of a bird zone.
Exactly, and you don't know, but in the spring following a forest fire, the green coming up through the black is really an extraordinary thing to see.
Actually, it is something that I've seen. It's a beautiful thing.
And I was up there, and there were many of these quite unusual woodpeckers, interacting with one another, and it was a great experience.
Oh, and thanks for your call. Greg, tell me something. After that crazy year that you went through in 1998, the big year, 715 birds, not the winning total, and I won't give away the conclusion of the book by saying much more than that, but do you still go out looking for birds?
Oh, absolutely. That was just that particular year was like a whole lifetime of travel and birding, all wrapped up in a single year. But no, I still go out and do it quite aggressively on occasion as well.
Were you out this weekend?
I was out Friday, in fact. I drove down to southern Ohio to see a prairie falcon, which is a bird that's very rare east of the Mississippi. So I was pretty happy to find that here in Ohio.
Mark Obmasek, the guy who wins the big year, like how big is the cash prize?
That's the thing with a big year. There is no cash prize. There is no trophy. There's not even a trip to Disneyland. I mean, that's one thing that I thought was so sweet about this story was that, I mean, if you think of what these guys did, all the miles they traveled, all the money they spent, there's no prize. But, I mean, the stakes in this community of birders are still pretty high. These guys had a million opportunities to cheat. I can never find one time when they did. I covered politicians for 17 years at the Denver Post. My first instinct is to be skeptical of what people tell me.
So some guy comes down off a mountain and says, I saw a red-legged, blue-tufted something or other. He doesn't have a camera. He doesn't have anything. And he's telling the truth. Is that what you're telling me?
Go figure. I mean, how many times have you seen a front-page newspaper story that says, honest men found? And this one, I got to say, for a while, it was frustrating to me because I'm just not used to finding that in journalism. But ultimately, I just thought, you know, what a cool thing. One of the guys, Sandy Comito, told me that. He said, you know, in birding, credibility is like virginity. You can only lose it once. These guys are like honest little boys. It's terrific to be around.
I want to thank you for being with us on the program today, Mark.
Well, thanks. That was really fun.
Mark Obmasek is the author of The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Foul Obsession. Greg Miller is one of the characters in his book. Greg, good of you to be with us. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And we'd like to welcome, as I mentioned earlier in the program, WKAR in East Lansing, Michigan, which begins broadcasting The Connection today. Special thanks to Mike Pappas at KUVO in Denver, Colorado, and Joe Gundren at WKSU in Kent, Ohio. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.